Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the first Peach State Pandemonium of the year 2012. This is Michael Norris, and as always, I am joined by my Rock'em Sock'em co-host, the Master Blaster Pastor, Bobby Simmons, and Tybee Allen's favorite dog catcher, the Georgia gentleman, Jerry Oates. How you guys doing this evening?
Doing good.
I'm glad you said that, Mr. Norris, because I had totally forgot, man. I read in the paper yesterday y'all got a cat napping ring or something going on up there.
You did not see that.
They said that people's cats were dying up there. It was in the Atlanta paper yesterday. There was a little blurb.
I cannot wait till I tell them this.
Let me ask you this. They haven't opened a Chinese restaurant on Tommy Island.
I just got my permit yesterday.
Seriously, there was a little blurb about 3 inches. It said that some people around some subdivision there said their cats had been dying and they had found some white powder around the cats and they were testing it. That's what it said.
I got a call 3 weeks ago. I was the first one to get a call about it. I go around there and this man tells me that they found 5 dead cats. I don't know if you've been around cat people, you know, people that feed these feral cats and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
Well, anyhow, there's just a nest of them down there, and this is called Savannah Beach Racquet Club, and it's a condos. And anyhow, they had over the 3 week period or 2 week period, then they had found 5 dead cats, and they suspected somebody of poisoning the cats, and there was a whole bunch of cats missing. And so I had to make a police report on all that and turn it over to the detectives, and it's turned into a big, big thing down there.
Well, the newspaper picked it up.
Yeah, it was on the news, the television down here, and everything.
Jeez,
it was a big thing.
Let me ask you, Jerry, did you have to draw chalk outlines around all the cats?
No, all the cats were gone when we got there. I'm the next thing to Columbus.
Now, besides being Baywatch, you're also CSI for Tybee Island.
That's right. I'm a one-stop party shop. That's a great
You have to get you some sunglasses like Horatio Kane.
I'm going to get me a trench coat like Columbo. Coolest it's been down here. I need one. My gosh.
I was going to ask you if you put your snow chains on your four-wheeler.
Need to, man. It's really been cold down here. I mean, for here, it's brutal.
Sonny got down to 24 here one day this week.
We had a 23.
That's about what it was here Monday, but then it was up to almost 80 today.
It was 60
something here today. 23 on the beach is brutal, I'm telling you.
Oh, yeah. I imagine that wind coming off that water.
Oh, good Lord. But I'm glad it's cold. It was a hot summer.
Yep.
You need to put out a fair warning that whoever those people killing those cats, they need to go ahead and turn themselves in before Debbie Simmons finds out about it. She comes down there with that cast on her hand and cleans house.
Oh, geez.
Oh, these people in uproar down there, man. I can't go anywhere. They're stopping me and hollering at me.
We got two cats that let us live here in the house with them.
Really?
One of them, our female cat is 20 years old.
Really?
And our little boy, well, the small cat, he's only 13 and he weighs about 18 pounds. So he kind of
20-year-old cat. How does it do? Good? Still get around good and all?
Jerry, she went deaf within the past 3-4 months. But other than that, she does fine.
No
kidding. She still runs. She still plays. She still eats good. She still runs this house. But
Bobby didn't elaborate on the eats good part. When they go out to dinner, they order separately a to-go box for this cat.
Yep.
This cat eats better than Bobby does sometimes.
Well, I figure, I don't know if cat years are measured like dog years or not. But if Mike, if you live to be 140, I'll bring you a little to-go box home too. Just, this cat's been a godsend for my wife. She is, she's my wife's nurse. She sleeps with her at night. And, just if Debbie don't feel good, this cat lays in her lap. It's amazing how these animals respond.
They know.
And this is, this is her baby. I mean, that's the name of the cat's name is Baby. Baby Cat Simmons. That's what's on her little registration thing. So she just... she's been here for 20 years. She walked up our driveway 20 years ago, and she didn't have any idea what kind of deal she had fell into. I gave Debbie, Michael, you hadn't even seen this because you left before I put it on, but I bought Debbie a bed warmer for Christmas. It goes over the mattress. It's under the sheets. And the cat sleeps in the bed with Debbie. She went back there the other night, and Debbie had that thing on, and she jumped up there, and she felt that warmth. She did about 3 loops, son. She plopped down and didn't move.
Well, I tried to find me a deal like that cat, and I never could.
Me neither. Me neither. When me and Debbie's been married 25 years in May, and I told her, I said, you make us a living, and I'll make life worth living. And now we both got fooled. I get up and go to work every day, and she stays here at the house.
See, that's the way it works.
We're gonna have a good show tonight, guys. We're gonna go back and revisit something that Jerry and I started on before we got hopelessly lost a couple of weeks ago. We're going to talk about wrestling magazines and publications and everything, and we're going to have 3 very distinguished guests, Tom Burke from Boston, who is probably the world leading expert among other things. He's a wrestling historian, but he's also probably the world leading expert on the Tony Santos promotion that ran up in New England for many years. Tom also wrote articles and stuff for the Ring Wrestling magazine. Also going to be joined by Dave Brzezinski, who is better known by his wrestling name of Supermouth Dave Drayson, who started as a photographer in the early 70s and worked on the Sheik's program there, the Body Press. He also did photography work out in L.A. for Michael Bell and various places, and then he ended up working in the business as a manager under the name of Supermouth Dave Drayson. And last but not least, our person who's actually already called in. I wasn't expecting him to call in, but I'll get him on the line here with us, our good friend Les Thatcher, who, among all the many hats he wore in the wrestling business, was also responsible for putting together programs in most of the territories he worked in. So let me get Les on the line. You there with us, Mr. Thatcher?
I'm here. What are you guys up to? Did I call? You said to call in at about 10 after 8.
Well, you're on time, Les.
Hey, I'm old, Oates, but my timing's still good.
Hey, it was always there.
I thought that, but that's fine. The more the merrier.
Listen, before we get into this thing about periodicals and magazines and stuff, is Reverend Simmons with us tonight?
I'm here, sir.
All right. Well, I have sort of a burning biblical question for me this week, Reverend.
Okay.
Will the same fiery tunnel to hell that was in the middle of the ring in Memphis Monday night, will that be in the middle of the ring next Monday night wherever Raw's at? And if so, does that mean the devil's under contract to Vince McMahon?
Probably so. Everybody else in the world seems to be.
Did you guys not see? None of you guys get the joke. Did nobody see it?
I didn't see it.
No?
I don't. Well, I don't watch his stuff. So.
Well, I fast forward through his stuff. No, at the end of the show Monday night, Kane came up out of the ring, through the middle of the ring, and drug woo-woo Zack Ryder, tried to drag him down into this hole with him, and Cena saved Ryder. And then all of a sudden, this fiery ball came up out of that hole, and the camera zooms. Cena and Ryder are back in the sitting on their butts back in the corner with this expression of some like 1938 Frankenstein movie on their face.
Oh,
and that was the end of the show. That's why I'm saying if that same hole's there next week, then the devil's got to be under contract to Vince, right?
Oh, geez.
Yes, sir. Yes,
sir. Anyway.
You got mine a couple of times by Frankie Kane, so you know what that's like.
Yes.
Hey, the only time I ever got a week off in this business with pay was when I got burned by the Sheik.
Yeah, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Bobby, since we're talking about publications and everything. Did they come to you, was that angle done to be able to do the article? Was the article done afterwards?
The article was done afterward. Danny Goddard did the article. He came to me and wanted to interview me. He wanted to do one of those question and answer type articles or whatever that magazine, I don't even remember what magazine, I think it was Wrestling Review. I've got a copy of it here somewhere.
No, I think it was an after magazine. It was either The Wrestler or Inside Wrestling.
One or the other. I'm not sure which one it was. But anyway, he came to me and wanted to do it, and I went to Barnett, of course, and asked because I wasn't going to do anything to jeopardize, you know, getting in heat with him, and he said he would prefer that I, you know, he said he didn't tell me not to do it, but he said he would prefer I didn't do it, so... Danny just wrote the article, and that's where that came from. Yeah, we did that deal in the Omni in Atlanta with the Sheik and Abdullah. When the Sheik threw the fire, Abdullah ducked and it hit me, and I got out of the. When I got back to the dressing room, we wrapped a towel around my head. They took me out the back door, and I went home. And when I got home, my phone was ringing when I walked in the door, and it was Ernesto. And Ernesto said, I want you to get in your car and disappear. And I said, well, where do you want me to go? He said, I don't care where you go. He said, just wherever you go, stay in the house. So I went to Columbus to my mother-in-law and father-in-law's, and I stayed in the house a week.
Mm-hmm.
And it was harder staying in the house a week not doing anything than it would have been if I'd have been working.
See, I got paid a week, too, up in the Carolinas doing the same thing. But I made the towns so they could introduce me in the ring. It was within the Charlotte TV range.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was a week off, come to think of it. Yeah. Oh. Do we get a badge for that, Bobby, or anything?
Oh, geez. You know, the hard part, I mean, I don't know what, when I came back, the next week when I came back, you know, they made me shave my eyebrows. We actually took a cigarette lighter and singed my hair. And they at one time they wanted me to sandpaper my face and put new skin all over it.
Yeah, and, been there, done that.
Oh, geez, man, I have that. You know, people think that's fun. They need to try that.
I shaved my left. I thought my eyebrow was never going to grow back.
Oh yeah.
When we did that in the Charlotte Coliseum, the minute that Weaver threw a towel over my head, they got me in the dressing room. Rudy Kay was waiting with his car out the back door of the dressing room with my bag and street clothes. And the minute I went in the front door, the locker room went straight out the back into the back on the floor at Rudy's car because he was my next door neighbor. So we'd already set this up. Went home, shaved that eyebrow, did the whole makeup thing with new skin and Mercure Chrome and the whole nine yards.
Oh.
And then talk about playing it by detail. I'd go into the office, every 3 or 4 days, and with Mr. Crockett, and he'd say, well, baby, maybe we should peel a little of it off, you know, taking the scab off and stuff. I mean, we played it for everything we get out of it. Yep. I don't know that ever made the magazine. Well, it made the program in Charlotte. That's where I first came up with the idea for Wrestler's Eye View as the name of a column. When Gene Gordon asked me if I would write J.C. Dykes was doing a weekly column called Likes and Dislikes by J.C. Dykes, and so that was who burned me. So anyway, he thought it would be a good idea if I did a column, you know, kind of a pro-con thing. And so he asked Mr. Crock, and he said, yeah, it's all, you know, as long as he keeps it sane. So anyway, I had to come up with a name, and that's where I got it. Yeah, you know, a lot of stuff in those magazines in the 70s were just pure made up. I mean, they took the pictures, you know, like Gene Gordon would send the pictures in, or, you know, whoever was shooting Little Al over in the Gulf Coast and whoever, wherever, and after, or, well, a lot of those guys would buy them and make up the stories, whatever they want. I worked with Hodge in Knoxville in the Coliseum, and for some reason Danny had a glove on his hand. And they shot pictures of it. I don't know what he thought anything about it. I didn't think anything about it. And several months later, a story came out in one of the after mags, you know, that I was horrified at the unsportsmanlike conduct of Danny Hodge wearing the loaded glove. And that wasn't even, it was never used as a gimmick.
Yeah, I remember that article. He had grown a goatee, and they were, you know, back in those days, whenever somebody turned heel, the first thing they did was grow a mustache or grow a goatee or bleach their hair. And I remember that article. Him working, I guess, you with a black glove on.
Yeah.
He was talking about, he was frustrated. I think Mantell was the junior heavyweight champion at that time, and they were talking about how frustrated Hodge was that he couldn't win the title back.
We went through time limit. They gave us 5 minutes more, and we went through that. They gave us 5 minutes more, and we went through that. And then they flipped a coin. Danny won the coin toss. But it was fun. Danny was good to work with. I mean, Jerry, did you ever work with him?
Never did.
No? Yeah, he was, that's, you know, I was telling some young guy the other day, I said, I've worked with some legitimately tough guys in my time and didn't even know they were there. And today you see these kids just kicking the hell out of each other.
Yeah.
Anyway,
Hodge was good to work for as long as you actually worked. As long as, you know, if he had a hold on you, you worked to try and get out of it. If you just laid there, he makes you pay for that. A lot of guys didn't like working with him because of that. My brother hated working with him. Because Sputnik just wanted to do his gimmicks and stuff like that. He didn't really want to work a match.
I can't speak for everybody else, but I've always thought today you have to explain that to some kids and say, you know, you need to work. They don't just lay there in it. The idea is to try to get out of it. Don't lay there and catch your breath to the next high spot. And just little subtle things like that that some people just don't teach. I enjoyed working a hold, selling a hold. Didn't you, Jerry?
Yes, I did.
I mean, did I got as big a kick out of, you know, I don't know how you and Teddy worked it, but I mean, when I was working tags, to set up the hot tag, I always thought that was fun to see how far along you could bring them damn people before you made that tag.
Exactly.
Anyway, magazines, awesome. Programs. You know, Charlotte, we did the first centerfold. We did the first all-four-color magazine with the Mid-Atlantic magazine that I did for Crockett. We did the only art front covers that I'm aware of, you know, that were done by an artist. You know, with I come up with a concept, and there was an artist there in Charlotte that would draw the covers for us. We were the first to do that, to do the centerfold, you know, theme centerfold and stuff.
I bet it did well, didn't it?
It did, yeah. In fact, at one point they were talking about trying to get in with a magazine distribution, you know, in that area, in the Carolinas, and you know, where the territories were. We did the only NWA magazine that was ever done in the 60s or 70s. Maybe even, I don't know. No, I had some old magazines from the 50s that were, NWA actually put out a magazine. But yeah, Jimmy came back from a meeting, so he said, I got a little project for us. And I said, yeah, what's that? He said, I volunteered you to do a magazine for the entire NWA. I said, well, I got nothing else to do. There was a page for every territory, and Terry Funk was a champion at the time, and he was on the cover in his centerfold. And it was one and done. The promoters, some of them sold it, some of them didn't know what to do with the damn things. And, you know, the funny thing back then, souvenirs or memorabilia weren't even part of the equation. We did Briscoe's and Thunderbolt, and I did the first T-shirts when we started our little company, and that was 71. Maybe 72, I guess. We put out a Briscoe Brothers T-shirt and a TP Power were the first two we put out. Jerry and I handled the shirts and stuff out of Charlotte. And I paid some young upstart wrestler $25 to do the black and the ink, pen and ink, for designs for the T-shirts of the Briscoes and the one at Thunderbolt. And I wish I had that today to sell back to somebody, because that upcoming young wrestler was Jerry Lawler.
Yeah, that's
he did the. Yeah.
Did you ever work in Kansas City, Les?
Yeah, sure. 1963.
You ever sell T-shirts in Kansas City?
No.
I knew this.
I'm not telling you, needed Jerry Oates to be your front man on your T-shirt sales, man. Your sales would have boomed.
I heard that.
I mean, it would have just went crazy.
Well, Oates is a marketing genius anyway.
Hey, everybody in Wichita, Kansas has a Jerry Oates T-shirt. That's true.
Okay.
Left
all right.
Story.
As Von Reschke would say, that's all the people need to know.
It's going to be good.
I know I'm going to get in trouble. If I ever pass through Tybee Islands and he catches me, I'm going to the dog pound.
Yeah.
I'm good at it.
Yeah. You know, the magazine business was good back then in the 60s and 70s.
It had to have been brutal, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they... but, you know, Norm Keitzer had a good magazine, Wrestling News, out of Mankato, Minnesota. And they set theirs up regionally. But that was Jim Melby first started doing his, writing, other than, just working for Vern was through Norm.
Was that that little bitty magazine? It wasn't a full size magazine, it was a smaller magazine, right?
Digest size.
Yeah, Wrestling News. Yeah. And
it was
he put them out.
Bob Luce.
Well, they did one for AWA, and then they did one for Oklahoma, they did one for when Watch started Mid-South.
Well, yeah, it wasn't digest size. It was smaller, Jerry, but it was smaller than the After Mags or Wrestling Review.
Right.
You know, it's smaller than the standard 8.5 by 11, but it wasn't digest size. But there was a digest size, I think, called Wrestling Life that Bob Luce in Chicago put out.
Yeah.
It was digest size. How I know about that is it sold in the arenas that Barnett ran in this area in the late 50s and early 60s. And then I don't know how long it was in business. You know, there was just a handful of guys that did the photography for all those magazines back in the 60s and 70s. I mean, when I say a handful, I had a photographer that worked the Carolinas, worked out of the office that Jimmy paid for our magazine too. But Gene Gordon, I bet you cannot pick up a magazine in the 60s and the 70s, anybody's wrestling magazine, that doesn't, you and find one picture, you'll find at least one picture that says you know, gives photo credit to Gene Gordon.
Gene Gordon, I mean, Little Al Vavasor.
Yeah.
Bob Leonard, who did Calgary and Buffalo. Did a lot of stuff in Buffalo. There was another guy in Buffalo, too, in the 50s and in early 60s, and I can't think of what his name was. Shirley Montgomery. Shirley Montgomery out in Los Angeles in the 50s, 40s and 50s.
I'll tell you, the greatest, you talk about the most artistic photographer for wrestling was Tony Lanza in Montreal.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, he got his start, he was a bodybuilder, and he started shooting bodybuilders. And so that's how he, you know, if you look at all his poses and everything, I mean, yeah, I would love to get my hands on the negatives of all that stuff that Tony Lanza did, because anybody that was anybody back in those days had a Tony Lanza shot.
I'll tell you what, Gene Gordon's, house full of negatives and pictures, my God, that's got to be so extensive. You could do 15 tabletop books. That was his whole. He had a small one-story house in Charlotte, and the entire living room was set up as a studio. I mean, as a, you know, like a, with backdrops and stuff, a studio. Most of the time, if you went there, there were boxes of negatives and pictures on his kitchen table. He had people mailing in, and you know, he sold individuals as well as the magazines. And Gene never drove. He either rode with somebody to, you know, towns or get on a bus. I know there were times he'd say, well, I'm going down to Columbia to Lillian's, and he'd get on a bus, go to Columbia, and Lillian put him up out at Moolah Manor for a couple days, and he'd shoot pictures of the girls and her, and, you know, and some, I don't know who did the stories, if Gene did the stories or somebody else, but... yeah, his pictures are in everybody's magazines. Everybody.
Is that all he did for a living?
Yes. Well, no, I take that back. He was a bellhop. I forget one of the I can't remember the name of the damn hotel. It was on Trade. It's not obviously not there any longer. It was on Trade Street, Jerry, down from Cafinas. Did you ever go to Cafinas? Was that there when you were there?
Not that I know of, Liz.
Okay, it was a Greek restaurant down on Trade Street downtown. Where a lot of in the 60s and early 70s, a lot of the guys hung. I mean, you know, we gravitated to the place in part because a bunch of the guys stay at Orvin Court around the corner or the Mecklenburg Hotel, which was right a couple blocks down Trade Street. So, but anyway, that was the deal. Yeah, Gene got around. And then, you guys talking about After magazines, Lou Eskin. Ran the Wrestling Review magazine.
Right.
And talking about Tommy Burke. Yeah, Ring was a boxing and wrestling magazine.
Right.
He bought
right.
The Ring magazine. The front half was boxing, and then there was a wrestling section in the back.
And then they split off about 68 or 69 and did a full wrestling magazine from there.
Yeah.
You were talking about Lou Eskin. He I think sometime in 74, he sold Wrestling Monthly and Wrestling Review to a group in Canada, and the quality went down here along. The Aftermags, they were, you know, their stories were pure kayfabe. Wrestling Review, Wrestling Monthly were a little bit more factual. They would, you know, most of their stuff was just reporting on different guys, you know, what territories they were working in, you know. A little bit
right.
of background on them. They didn't get into the, you know, the Russian plot to kill Andre the Giant because Ivan Koloff couldn't beat him and all that stuff like Bill After that group did. But once he sold them off to the Canadian group, all the focus became on Detroit. The Sheik was on every cover, and the paper quality went down. They were rerunning old articles from, you know, the late 60s. You know, like they were still, you know, they'd run an article on Johnny Powers when he still had blonde hair, you know, 1975. So, stuff like that. But there were a lot of them out there, like Big Book of Wrestling. I don't think they did. I think they recycled everybody's stories because, you know, you find one from Wrestling World or something like that, and it'd be recycled 10 years later in the big book of wrestling. And, but what was Charlotte the first territory you worked on, did programs?
That just evolved for some, I don't even, you know, it was a casual thing. They hadn't done a photo album in a while. I mean, when I say that, I just happened to be looking at, I think I was at Gene Gordon's getting some pictures taken, and he had a bunch of the Crockett Promotions photo album, you know, where they put guys' pictures with a little caption under them, right, and sell them as, and then you could get the guys to autograph on them, too. Anyway, I was looking, and I said to Mr. Crockett, just offhand, I said, you know, you guys haven't put out a photo album in a while. He said, no, we haven't. I said, I don't see have time. He said, have you got the time? I said, what do you mean if I got the, or something like that, you know, and I said, well, I guess. He said, well, then why don't you put one together? I said, really? He said, yeah, I'll pay you for you to do it. So the first thing I ever did was just put a photo album together and, like, put some, you know, a caption underneath each picture, you know, with, like, hometown or, you know, something, you know, so. And that's how it started. Then, for some reason, I decided to try a program. And at one point, when I was living in Atlanta, I was doing the Charlotte Monthly eight-page program from my dining room table in Forest Park and mailing it all north and doing the weekly program for Atlanta. That besides Atlanta, where else to sell, Bobby? In Augusta?
Augusta. All the Atlanta towns, Savannah.
Yeah.
Fred Ward did his own thing for Macon and Columbus. I think Jim Carlisle put his together for him.
Yeah. But, yeah, and then from the eight page, it's just, you know, I don't even know how we got off on the idea to do the, you know, the four color. I mean, how we even escalated into that. It's just at one point, you know, he said, I think Jimmy said to me, he said, well, let's be Jimmy Jr. by this time. You know, would you be interested just doing a magazine? And I said, well, let's try one and see. And so anyway, then they set me up with an office in the office there on Briar Bend with a light table and, you know, and pretty much, you know, had, I mean, if there's something I thought might be a little too modernistic or untraditional that Jimmy, you know, I'd go to Frances first, his sister. She helped out some with it too. And I'd say, Frances, I got this idea and I'd like you to run it by Jimmy because she could usually get it through if, you know, he wouldn't mess with Frances. But anyway, I mean, you know, so that's how the magazine escalated. And then somebody else did a copy that wasn't, I don't know why it wasn't as good, but it just, the quality color, I don't know if they changed printers or what. This was after I'd moved up to Knoxville. And then it petered out altogether. I did the first WWWF magazines off the same format. After we had done the NWA magazine, New York got some of those because at that, you know, WWWF, Vince Sr. was in the NWA, even though he seldom used a champion or anything. So anyway, Napolitano, George contacted me and he said, would you like to, you want to put together a similar magazine for Vince and I, Vince being Vince Jr. And I said, yeah, we were, you know, so that George had shipped me pictures, ideas, incomplete stories. And the girl that I was dating at the time, she and her sister and I would spread all this out on the floor of my apartment and lay it out, you know, rough. I mean, when I say lay it out, it was all taken to an artist and done, you know, professionally too, but separate, you know, do this spell check, you know, correct this, that, and the other thing and put it, you know, and put it together. And then I'd take it to the artist with the idea and everything. And then our printer in Charlotte did the printing and it was shipped up to Georgia, New York. And he took care of distribution for Junior. But that, well, I don't know what. Go ahead. I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead,
I was going to say, I don't know. Two tackles, drop down, get it again, Mike. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to say Tom's calling in. He's been holding for us, but I want to go ahead and get him on the line with us, Tom Burke. And so hang on just a second. Tom, you there?
I'm here, Mike.
Fantastic. Before we go any further, let me. And I know this was you were probably a little small boy back then, but did you ever see Les Thatcher work for Tony Santos?
Before he answers this question, let me tell you that Tom Burke is the oldest living Les Milady fan in professional wrestling.
Well, is that in the male gender?
In the male gender.
We have Diane Devine, who's in the female gender, Les.
Whoa, where do I tell Diane that you're saying she's older than you are? All right.
Well, how are you, Les? Happy New Year to everyone.
Happy New Year to you, Tommy. No, you know, Mike, Tom and I do, seriously, we go back to when I started in the business. That's when we first met.
Yeah, back in the 60s.
Yep.
What's that, Les?
I said he used to go to all the Santos matches.
That was the only thing we had up here.
Right.
You know, and, you know, God bless them, I'll tell you. I wish I could, if I could turn the clock back and change the way wrestling was, I wouldn't change it at all. I'd still have the Santos promotions up here. They were phenomenal. I mean, you know, it was a home atmosphere. The guys were great, good talent, solid talent, you know. And, you know, Santos ran basically 6 days a week, you know.
Yeah.
And in the summertime, he'd have three crews. I mean, you know, and without TV.
Well, you know, just in the time that I was there, 60 and 61, through that small community came, talk about some good workers, Pat Patterson, Alex Medina, Ronnie Dupre, Terry Garvin, Luke Graham, Rufus R., Bob Harmon, who else? Ronnie Garvin came through there later.
Frank Shields there when you were there? He came after, though.
Who, Scarpa?
No, Frank Shields, Bo Belinsky.
Oh, no, Well, Shields was driving a cab in Boston when I first started up there.
Okay.
Yeah, but he was working part-time for Tony.
Yeah, he had a fabulous crew.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was your time up there before or after the Pfeffer involvement?
Pfeffer was always in and out. Before I got there, the best I tell you, Mike, and I don't know this for sure because obviously I was too young to sit down and talk business with Tony on that level, but from the rumor or stories that went around is that Pfeffer had bailed Tony out at some point financially. I don't know if that's true or not. And so Tony really was beholden to Jack. And so we're talking about programs and magazines and stuff. You knew when Jack Pfeffer was in because the Santos the pictures were 9,000 years old with funny names. And you say, okay, Pfeffer's here.
Coming soon.
The sound of life,
Yeah, coming soon. Somebody that's been dead for 20 years, you know?
Exactly. Franz Von Erich and Lou Tez.
Bruno San Martino.
Les, who was Lou Tez? Do you have any idea?
Who was who?
Lou Tez.
I have no idea, Bobby. I don't know.
That has been bugging me for years.
Yeah, he made it up as he went along.
Yeah. I think there were a couple of them.
You know what's so funny, though, is that what a memory that little son of a gun had. I was just learning the business. Hell, I wasn't important in that situation up there at the time and barely ever spoke to him. But the next time I saw him was in 67 in Charlotte when Kirby and I came in out of Florida. And I was parked my car down behind the old office at 1111 East Moorhead, and was going in to, you know, to say hello, and I had just gotten the territory, and here come Pfeffer down the stairs, down the back steps, and you know, and at this point, you know, I had, my hair was, I was bigger, and you know, obviously a number of years older, and I said, "Hi, how are you?" And he said, "Les Belady." I can't do the Jack Pfeffer impersonation. And I said, "Yeah." You know, I was so amazed that he remembered who I was.
Isn't that funny? That's
yeah.
a great story.
But he had girls, I forget, a couple black girls, maybe, I don't know who it was at the time. They were just finishing up when I saw him there. But yeah, every time he came to Boston, the program took on a whole nother level.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you didn't cross paths with him and when you guys were down working in Louisiana for Lee, because he came in. He may have been there maybe 66 ahead of you guys, but he came through and spent a couple weeks touring with a girl called the Lady Blimp, and he was actually riding to all the towns with her, according to what Kelly's told me.
I'll tell you a hell of a book to read. Mike, talking about publications, Tommy, I'm sure, has read it. Fall Guys, Tom?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I've been able to find a copy of it.
By Marcus Griffin. That was really the first book that really opened up the business, per se.
And that was done by, what, if I'm correct, if I remember right, a newspaper...
A newspaper guy, yeah.
Guy
yeah.
from Chicago, wasn't it?
It might have been Chicago or New York. I can't remember.
Yeah, it was done in 38, 39.
30, yeah, about in the 30s, late 30s,
yeah.
First
book I saw of it, here we go, Gene Gordon again. Gordon had picked this book up in front of Woolworths, had a sidewalk sale in downtown Charlotte, and he just happened to see the title and got it for like 50 cents or something.
Oh, that's a bargain.
Yeah, and I don't know whatever happened to it, but... Anyway, he let me read it, and I remember the first, the opening stanza was, "You call it wrestling, they call it working."
Yeah.
And it,
yeah, that's
it
funny,
had a,
huh?
Yeah, yeah, amazing. But he tells the whole story, you know, the whole Pfeffer thing, and
there was if I remember correctly, there's a story about Hans Steinke hanging Jack Pfeffer out of a hotel window. Because
yeah.
he didn't like his payoff, you know. But I gave him more money. You know.
I'll tell you, for you guys that never actually saw the guy, he looked like a derelict. I mean, he did. Except if you didn't see the big, you know. I mean, his nails were long and his hair was gray and yellow. I mean, it was, you know, it never cut properly. And
yeah, and he had that pinky ring.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you, here's a funny story. I don't know if, Tommy, if you ever heard this or not. At the old Boston Arena on St. Vital Street, he was Joe Sasso, who had played football at Boston.
Oh,
remember Sasso?
Yeah, Joe Red.
Yeah,
Sasso.
Yeah. Exactly. Anyway, I guess Sasso didn't know who he was. And Sasso was the first guy in the Babyface's dressing room. They were running the arena. And Pfeffer had gone in there and laid down on a bench to take a nap. And Sasso thought it was some bum that sneaked in the back door. A homeless guy. And he was going to throw him out. And Pfeffer said, "No, you dummy, I am Pfeffer."
Oh, that's great.
So, Sasso got off to a good start with Pfeffer.
That's funny.
Well, speaking of that, did you hear that Punk could get in the Garden the other night?
I heard that.
Yeah. Security guy didn't believe he was a wrestler.
That's funny. Not enough roids, I guess.
He's the only guy on that roster that claims to be a wrestler. You know, the rest
entertainer. Yeah. I like him. I think he's great myself.
Yeah, I do too.
Yeah.
I do too. Listen, guys, I'm going to bail here and let Tommy take center stage here. He's more about history than I. He knows more about this stuff than I do anyway.
Hey, Les, good talking to you. Are you going to Mobile, Les?
I'm sure going to try. Mike Norris will try to block the highway or something, but I'm. Oh. Hey, Oates, are you coming?
I'm planning on coming.
Okay. Are you coming, Oates? Huh?
They're supposed to pick me up.
They're supposed to pick you up. Oh.
By boat?
Are you going to pick you up and take you around the peninsula or what?
Yeah, I could. Are you driving?
What? Hell yes, I can't afford to go any other way.
I'll put you on 16, Interstate 16.
No, we're going to Maggie Valley first. And then we'll come down to Atlanta.
Well, you sure swing by Savannah.
Why, it's just a couple of miles out of the way, right? Sure.
It'd be worth it.
You could hitchhike to Atlanta and ride with Simmons.
I told him I'd meet him in Macon. That's a little more than halfway for him.
You got Bobby, these old guys, they can't make them long trips.
I know about long trips, brother.
Talk to me.
I worked for Watts, if you'll remember.
Hey, I never worked for Watts, but I think the longest, Jerry, you'll appreciate this because you were there. Kirby and I came out of, we did TV in Minneapolis on Monday and drove all night through to Kansas City. Where the hell we go? Wichita on Tuesday. No. Yeah, Wichita on Tuesday. Hastings, Nebraska for TV on Wednesday. Dodge City on Thursday.
Oh, my gosh.
And back to St. Joe on Friday. How about that, sports fan?
Yeah, that Dodge City wasn't a joke either, getting out there.
That was putting some miles on, brother.
Yes, it was. You enjoyed every minute of it, too, didn't you?
Yes, I did. What could I tell you? Yes, I absolutely
did. There you go.
Did. Yep. It was called working. It was
and gas the was wheel. Cheap.
Yeah, there you go. Tommy, Burke.
Okay.
I'll see. You going to be a Mobile, Jerry?
I'm planning on being there.
For any of you fans that are listening, if you will send your dimes and nickels to this P.O. box, and it's Get Jerry Oates the Mobile Fund.
Yes. Well, Les, you might have heard about my telethon I want to have, or my radiothon.
No.
Yeah, what? We're going to have a radiothon, and really, it's for you and Dick Steinborn. We're going to try to get y'all some help to get you to come out of your shell a little bit to so you can communicate better. I thought you guys were the first ones I thought of.
I'm not sure if that's an insult or a compliment.
Exactly a compliment.
Hang with Dickie.
Let me throw one thing in here before you get away, Les. And I thought about this today. You know, we're talking about magazines and programs, and I'll bring it down to a program level. When I first went to work for Barnett, Freddie Miller, of course, was there, and he was doing a program. And Freddie's idea of the program was he threw 8, 10, 12 pictures in there and charged a buck and walked away. That was the end of it. When Freddie left the office and Barnett came to me and he said, "Will you take it over and do it?" I kind of went back to, I mean, I looked at what had been done before. I mean, a program was a great promotional tool if it was used right.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, not only could you make a buck off of it, but you could. I went to Ole and told him what I wanted to do, and Ole said, "Well, who thought of that?" And, you know, I said, "Just give me some idea who you got coming down the road in 2 months. Let me plug it. Say you've been scouting talent and wherever." Yeah, it just and we could put hints in there and ideas. I did it under the guise of Paul Jones. I was in the promoter's corner, whatever I called it. But
right.
What a great promotional tool. And you were, you know, your wrestler's eye view and the things that you know, that was something that I picked up from you and looking at your old programs. It was just a. What a tool!
You know what? I'm
going to
tell you where I
never used it.
I'll tell you where I kind of got the inspiration to play around with that was when I came into Atlanta in '66. The first time I ever went in the office, Leo was doing the program. And I was just fascinated by the way he was, you know, I did watching him, you know, lay it out and everything. And at the time, they were starting to build for Tim Woods for Wrestling One. And I was, what you were just saying there, a good promotional tool, because they were making him well known through that program before he ever stepped foot on television or in a ring.
I'm not trying to be funny when I say this. I was just a kid. I was the biggest fan you ever saw. I can remember seeing his picture, Mr. Wrestling Coming Soon, for 3-4 months before he got there.
Yeah, yeah.
And you knew who the guy was. He was over before he ever got there.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. That was a big – well, you know, the first two-ring battle royal, I'm no damn artist, but we designed – you know, I did themes, but I'm like you. That's, to me, what the columns were for. And, you know, just it kind of set the stage for the people. You got there a half hour before the show started or 45 minutes or whatever, and the program kind of set the stage for you, you know.
Yeah.
Who likes who and who's mad at who and why are they mad and on and on and on. You know, yeah, it's more than just pictures. Absolutely. Absolutely. But Leo's the one that gave me the inspiration to try it. And I did one in Charlotte for a while. I did Charlotte, Knoxville for a while. Roy Lee did one up there too. But part of the deal with me coming into Atlanta when they approached me to come down there besides the television and eventually work was, to be in the office and handle the program and public relations. Leo was my inspiration. But, yeah, I'll tell you what, Bobby, when I first came into that office, those pictures were – I forget, what was the photographer's name that shot every Friday night?
Oh, God, there was a guy named Bill Evans that did it for a while.
I think that's who it was. But anyway, he'd bring me the pictures in Monday or something, whenever, you know, and I'd pick out what I wanted. But he had been bringing them in there for I don't know how long, and nobody put them in any kind of order. So I spent, a month setting up files, you know, in alphabetical order, the pose stuff, and then if the action shots – the way I cataloged them was using the first initial of the last name of whoever was in the offensive position. You know, if you're body slamming Jerry, then it would be under under Simmons. You know,
right.
If Jerry were body slamming, you'd be under Oates. But when Louise showed me that stuff, I said, "Oh my God, this is horrible." But anyway, yeah. But that was, you're right. It's a good promotional tool if done correctly. You know, and nobody does programs anymore anyplace,
no.
I don't think.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, I'm sure I don't go to the souvenir stands at WWE shows, but I'm sure they've got some big glossy, catalog type thing, which probably doesn't have a thing to do with that particular night's show. Just like we were talking about earlier, a photo album or something. Anyway, I'm going to bail out of here, you guys, and I expect to see all of you. Love you all, and I expect to see you, Oates, in Mobile.
Yes, sir.
All right. We got things to do, man.
Yes.
All right, you guys. Love you all, man. Talk to you later.
Love you
too,
little
man. Tom, I was going to ask you, how did you get involved with ring wrestling? Because I know you wrote for them.
Well, I started writing for ring wrestling when I was in high school. I would have been probably about 64. I was reading all these agate columns in the back of the magazines, and I said, I could do one of these. So anyways, I started writing it and, adding bits and tits of information that was going on in New England. And luckily for me, my high school was right next to the main library. So I'd go there almost every day to look at the out-of-town newspapers, and I'd just write notes from Seattle, Portland, and wherever else. And I'd just add little tidbits. I'd read about results or something. And I got involved and went there, and then later, years later, I started, you know, working for them, and you know, on a basically a, not a, a full time basis on their staff, till they finally were sold out, and then it was a different ball game, you know.
Yeah.
But that was a, it was a fun time, and it was, you know, and then I worked for Lou Eskin on Wrestling Review, and Tommy Kaye from Big Book of Wrestling, and all those. A couple of those other publications he ran and everything. And I did Ring Sport from England. I did a USA Report and the Wrestler from, not the British Wrestler magazine, not the After Rags. So,
right.
You know, but it was, you know, so it was a long, it was a good run. It was a very good run. Yeah.
Well, I guess somebody else is calling in, our other guest, unless somebody I know, you know, from the WFIA days. He was known before he got in the business as Dave Brzezinski, who was a photographer for the Sheik and put together the program for Big Time Wrestling out of Detroit. Their program was called the I think it was a body press or something
body
like
press,
that.
Yeah.
Then Dave eventually found his way into the business and became better known as Supermouth Dave Drayson. So let me get him on the line with us. Dave, you there?
I'm here.
Well, welcome to the show, man. We got Tom Burke on the line with us, as well as Jerry Oates and Bobby Simmons and myself.
Hi, T. Francis Burke.
Hey, how you doing, Davey?
I'm doing wonderful. Nice to talk to Mike, my brother, who I've never met, who I appreciate so much for doing everything for us on the Kayfabe Memory sites right now, that I think we're the hit of professional wrestling right now on the Internet. Jerry Oates, who I have so much respect for, after we did the last show when I called in with Mickey Doyle, me and Mickey Doyle talked, I have so much respect for you, Jerry. And Bobby Simmons, thank you for mentioning my good friend Danny Goddard. Both of you are reverends and, you know, icons in this business.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. The check's in the mail.
Yeah, well, if you were ever a promoter, that check's going to bounce.
Well, now, Dave, I'll tell you a step further. You actually know my wife.
I do.
Yes, you do.
Yes. Vicky?
No, I didn't marry Vicky. Now, Vicky married a guy named Daniel Simmons.
Exactly, yeah.
We're no kin.
Uh-huh.
Chris Simmons. I got to get the name right now. But I married Debbie Hester.
I'll be darned. You lucky dog.
Hey, I think so. We've been married 25 years come May.
Well, congratulations, my friend.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're a beautiful gal. You're a very lucky man.
He says I'm lucky. Debbie, she's sitting over here smiling.
Well, if she looks half as good as she did back in the day, you know, you're a lucky man.
Oh.
And, you know, so is she. So.
I appreciate that.
But thanks for having me on this show. I mean, this is a great thread that we're doing today. You know, I'm sorry Les isn't on because, you know, Les had so much to do with the business, you know, in the early 60s when, you know, programs and stuff were first really, you know, starting to take off in the business. You know, and, you know, he mentioned Wrestling Life, but there was also Wrestling As You Like It. That Bob Luce did out of Chicago, the little small magazines. But in the day, I mean, Wrestling Review, fall issue 1959, Jerry and Eddie Graham on the cover, that really started the revolution of wrestling magazines.
Yeah, that you're right. That first edition of Wrestling Review really started a trend, and magazines started to become, shall we say, overall, a major input, whereas Wrestling Life and Wrestling As You Like It, even though they were sold nationally, they were catered to basically the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
They have columns in there, regional columns, but they didn't focus on the boys from the West Coast or the East Coast, whereas Lou Eskin, or actually Stanley Weston at the time, who started a review and walked away with the Ring Wrestling Files, thank you, and he ended up starting Wrestling Review and was, you know, it turned out to be a very excellent publication. And then, of course, there's issues there when he left there and started his own other publication, The Wrestler, and all that, all those spin-off magazines, and then Lou Eskin took over Review, which was still maintained a high-quality magazine, both in print and in text.
Yeah, and then, like, you guys mentioned, touched on earlier about how Ring Wrestling, you know, was a boxing wrestling magazine, more boxing than wrestling.
Yeah.
But it turned into the premier wrestling magazine, you know, once it went all wrestling.
Oh,
I
absolutely.
I mean, it seems like a lot of us guys who back in the day were writing the stories and, you know, taking the pictures for Wrestling Review and then Wrestling Monthly, you know, when that came out, you know, and then when Ring Wrestling went all wrestling, you know, it seems like all of us, call us premier writers or whatever, really went over to Ring because that was, like, really the truth. It wasn't, like the After mags. You know, I
right.
would send photos into Bill After, and it's like, you know, that's all he would use is my photos, and then he would write the stories around it.
Exactly, you know? Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, Ring Wrestling and Wrestling Review and Monthly, which, we did, that, you did interviews and talked to the guys, and, you know, you took the pictures of them, and you built the story around your pictures and everything, and everything, you know, I mean, it was still a little kayfabe and he'll, you know, here and there, but you were still marking out, really, to the crowd that was reading all this kind of stuff.
Exactly, yeah. And, I think where the downfall took place on wrestling programs, and I might get a little heat on this from some people, but when Norman Kaiser started Pro Wrestling Enterprises and he was doing a program for Vern, which
mm-hmm.
was fine, but then he started to spread nationally. And soon all these regional promoters, they hooked up with him
yep.
and he was doing their programs. But you could buy a program in Minneapolis, you could buy a program in Tulsa. It was the same format over and over again.
Yeah,
and
it was the same stories and stuff.
Basically, yeah, same story. You know, well, not maybe the same stories, but the idea was the same. It wasn't in depth or anything, but the local feel was gone. And I look at some of these issues that he put out, and I just shake my head because so many areas, so many territories has some great, wonderful programs, and then. They switched over and had him do it, and it just ruined the program business.
Mm-hmm. Well, before I get into the program thing, I'll say one more thing on the magazine kind of thing. Remember what we used to get paid for stories in, say, Wrestling Review, Tom?
Oh, yes.
$25.
Yeah, which was big money back then.
Yeah, I'd get $25 for, my pictures.
Yeah.
And then, they told me if you wrote a story with the picture, you'd give $50.
Mm-hmm.
So now here I am, a kid. I'm 13, 14 years old, writing these stories for a national magazine, getting my name printed, and I'd get $50 for a story. And sometimes, for a monthly issue, I'd get two stories in there if I was lucky. So here in 1968, 1969, they're sending me checks for $100. I'm a kid just out of grade school, and it was great money.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Most of the boys worked back in those days.
Yeah, and then plus the fact is, the boys realized that you could get them print and ink, and they befriended you.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a different ballgame. Ronnie Dupree said to me one time, we were talking about, he said, back in the day, in the early 60s, before Review started in 59. So he said, like 58, when he was 55, when he first started. He said, the only magazine out there that had anything in wrestling was the Ring magazine,
mm-hmm.
And it was a focus for these guys to get to know people so they could get some print. Because it was just publicity for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, getting off the, situation of the magazines, now me here in Detroit, I really like to talk about the Body Press. Because to me, the Body Press magazine, I don't know if you guys have, seen that down in Georgia and, Alabama and, those kind of territories. But I think we had the premier, all-time best program in the history of professional wrestling.
Well, your program, the Body Press, was different than any other program that was being published by any of the promoters. Your program was a magazine format.
Mm-hmm.
The average issue would be 16 pages.
Exactly.
And you would have regular magazine features aimed, of course, promoting the guys on the cart.
Mm-hmm.
And everything. And then if somebody was coming in, there'd be, you know, coming soon, so and so, you know.
Yep.
And then, but you know what? What always intrigued me was the back cover, because they would have the listings where big time wrestling could be seen, and they would have probably 3 to 4 columns,
yep,
of TV stations in the Midwest and elsewhere where the Sheik's promotions could be seen. You know,
that really was. Yeah, he was really
ahead of his time.
Oh, of course. You know, think of, you know, how McMahon is now, you know, across the country. You know, Sheik's, you know, TV tapes went all over the country. I mean, from out west to the East Coast, Virginia's, Georgia, Florida, everywhere. You know, he was cable before, you know, cable was really known.
I got to go. I'm going to kill this kid. So, anyways, somebody just put a thing on my Facebook. I'm going to kill him. Anyways,
what are you looking at Facebook? You're on the radio, Tommy.
I know that. But, Dave, I have a message for you anyways.
Okay.
Every Thursday, I meet with Fred Curry.
Uh-huh.
And he told me to say hello to you because I told him you would be on tonight.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Freddie.
He's gone. but you're absolutely
if
right.
If it was Bull, I would really get excited.
Yeah, a lot of people get excited if he showed up again. But overall, I think you're right about the program out of Detroit. It was definitely one of the best.
And, you know, the one thing is, you know, what other promotion around the country or in the world, you know how many, you know, body presses the Sheik printed per issue? And, you know, usually his shows were every 2 weeks. You know, and then there was times when during the Bruiser, you know, promotional war, we were doing a program every week for a while. So, you know, he printed 10,000 programs.
Wow.
You know, and not only were they sold in Detroit, but they were sold all over the territory. The thing he would do is take out the center section, you know, with the rundown of the Detroit card, and everything else was just generic from there, the stories and the photos.
Uh-huh.
You know, but, you know, when I first was, you know, so lucky, you know, to get hired by the Sheik and, you know, do the program, first I started just taking the pictures for it. But then there was a gentleman, there was a worker called Frankie Diamond. And he came up to me one day and says, I'm leaving the territory, I'm going to Kansas City. And I, you know, basically wrote all the stories for the program. And he knew that I wrote for Wrestling Review and, you know, Ring Wrestling. He says, you know, I'll talk to, you know, Joyce and the Sheik for you, you know, if you would want to write the program. And this was like late 1970, early 1971. And I said, you know, sure. So, you know, they would pay me, they said they'd pay me $5 per story. So, you know, with a 16-page magazine, I had averaged 10 stories per issue. And, you know, I just remember being a 14-year-old kid sitting on my bed with this little typewriter typing out these stories. And here's a 14-year-old kid, you know, making up all the kayfabe stuff. You know, I just have to get it in my head, you know, who I was doing the story on, be it, you know, the Sheik, Bobo, you know, Haystacks Calhoun, whoever it was. You know, you'd have to come up with something every 2 weeks, you know, to capture, you know, the attention of the Detroit, you know, fans. So I was trying to write for them what I thought I would want to read. You know, and sometimes I'd be in the dressing room and you'd ask the guys, you know, for ideas and stuff like that. Some were pretty receptive for it. Some couldn't care less. But you had guys like Killer Brooks. It's like, you know, me and him would sit down. It's like, okay, let's say we're in a cemetery today. You know, you just happen to be driving by. You saw Killer Brooks, you know, laying by a headstone in a cemetery. Just take it from there. And it's like, you know, it was so easy with guys like that. You know, then, or you'd have something like Bobo, who, you know, for years he'd go against the Sheik and he couldn't win the title. You know, so, you know, it's like, okay, I'll just do a story on Bobo that says, I'm going to retire. And that would capture, you know, the attention of the fans. They see that in the program, Bobo Brazil's going to retire. It's like, whoa, what's this, you know? And they'd read the thing, if I don't beat the Sheik and if I don't get a title shot, I'll retire, you know, which wasn't going to happen. But, you know, it was a lot of fun. And then, of all things, you know, me doing 10 stories per program, you know, and we had, you know, the author, you know, who wrote the story on there, but I couldn't put my name on all 10 stories. So as, you know, everybody knows, you know, all my friends from back then, I'd always use Tom Burke's name, T. Francis Burke. I'd always use Diane Devine, Tom Roberts, Burton Cutler, Danny Goddard. So all the, you know, all my friends from around the wrestling, you know, country got their name printed at that time in the, you know, the body press programs.
I didn't get paid for that.
I'm assuming you both.
One of my favorite programs.
Go ahead, Tom.
Am I on?
Go ahead, Danny.
Oh, okay. One of my favorite programs is from down in Mobile that was put out back in the 60s called A Southern Wrestler. I always enjoyed that. It was a four-page program with a lineup box with pictures, of course, and promos. But it was just the way it was laid out with a picture of Robert E. Lee and the Confederate flag behind it. I always thought that was kind of neat. Another program I liked, of course, were the Tony Santos programs. The programs from Los Angeles were always good, too. I like those and, you know, some of the others. But definitely Detroit was one of my favorites because it was a magazine format. And the Charlotte programs were good, too.
Wasn't it called the Ringsider?
The Ringside. That was Atlanta.
Okay.
That was Atlanta.
Yeah, that was Garrett Baldy's
convention. Yeah. One program that
just to correct, the Southern Wrestler was actually Birmingham. That wasn't Mobile.
Was that Mobile?
Yeah.
Well, no, Birmingham. I apologize. Okay. Same state, wrong city.
Mobile did have one. Mobile was real sporadic. That's the territory I grew up. I grew up in this down here in Mobile, and they were real sporadic as what they had. Somewhere around 65, 66 for a two-year stretch, they would run, they put together a program that was sold in both Pensacola and Mobile because they would one Pensacola was on Tuesday night, Mobile was on Wednesday night.
Uh-huh.
They had the lineup start for both nights, you know, in this one magazine and print that. Don Fields actually did that, but it only lasted about a year. Then they didn't do anything until Leo Garibaldi came down here in 74. He spent about 6 months down here helping Bob Kelly book the Mobile end of the territory. And he recreated what he'd done in Atlanta with the Ringsider. He had it here in Mobile. It was called the Ringside Reporter. And it was the same basic format, same layout, everything. And that was the only time that Mobile ever had programs weekly on a consistent basis. I mean, every once in a while they put together a little something with pictures and sell those. But the most interesting thing that I came across and had one as a kid and lost mine over the years, but then a couple of years ago at the Mobile reunion, they were reselling them. In 71, when Don Fargo came back down here, they had put together a thing that was, I think it's like 16 photos. And it's a photo of the wrestler on one side, on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side is one of Don Fargo's caricatures of that same wrestler with some little funny caption on it.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you guys have ever seen Don stuff, but he did stuff like that just about every territory. Mainly he did it for the boys. I know most of the guys in Amarillo he did stuff for. Tito Carrion is on Facebook, and he every once in a while will put up some of Don's stuff. that Don has drawn, but he did that here. And that actually, I took that idea when I was breaking in the business. I started working in 79, but in 80 or 81, I don't remember when it was, I approached Roy Lee Welch. When Ron Fuller had this territory down here, I approached him and Jerry Stubbs, and we put together a program that I actually drew. I did the same thing. We didn't use real photos of it. I just drew caricatures of all the guys that were working in the territory. And we put this thing together and sold it. They had Charlie Plant advertised it on the TV show and everything. And naturally, when it came time to get my money, there was nowhere to be found. I was told that, you know, they were having to give them away. They really weren't selling and all this stuff. And about a year and a half later, I was working in Dothan. I went to lunch with Larry Brott. The subject of that magazine came up, and I said, you know who drew that, don't you? And he said, well, Roy Lee told us it was a 12-year-old boy in a wheelchair. I said, no, it was me. That's what they were doing. They were telling people that it was a 12-year-old boy in a wheelchair, and he was trying to raise money to have an operation. And those things were selling like hotcakes, and I never saw a dime out of it.
Uh-huh.
I told that story to Bob Boyer at a reunion about 10 years ago, and he said, well, why do you think they're called Welch?
That's funny.
Well, Tom, it's like it really amazes me when you look back at programs over the course of, you know, the glory years of, you know, professional wrestling. Like in the 60s and 70s, you know, New York, who had one of the biggest territories, you know, just say New York and Boston, they had some of the worst programs on the face of the planet. They were like
the Philadelphia programs were totally the worst. Every week, when they'd have their shows, the program would come out. Camden, New Jersey, the same thing, because it was all Phil Zacco's territory. Those were his towns.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a small digest program, four, maybe eight pages, pictures, a lineup, local ads, and it would be Know Your Wrestling. They'd have the same holds, showing the holds or the history of wrestling with these Greeks. Is the same thing. They're, you know, very, very seldom they would have anything pertinent to the show itself. Occasionally, they'd have a little blurb, you know, somebody coming in soon or something like that. But that was it. Those programs were horrible.
Yeah, they were really bad. But I think, now here's a little trivia kind of thing also. What programs had lucky numbers in them where fans could, you know, win tickets to the next show or something?
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we had those. There were nothing like that in Body Press, and I don't really recall seeing those in the Northeast. I think that was a Southern thing mostly.
No, Body Press had them every week.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Oh, yeah. That was a big thing for Body Press. Okay. They would call out 10 lucky numbers in intermission.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I'll have to grab his program and look. I don't remember seeing those.
Well, what Duelist did, it wasn't necessarily a lucky number. They had, can you identify this wrestler? They'd have some guy that, you know, worked there.
The mystery wrestler. Yeah, we did that in Atlanta for a while.
Yeah, the mystery wrestler. Atlanta did it as well.
I'll tell you something else we did in Atlanta for a while, too. We would take a picture of the program or a page of the program, and we would print four, maybe break it up into four pictures on a page, just candid random shots of the crowd, and we would circle a face.
Yeah.
And if you brought the program down and that was your face, you know, you win a couple of tickets to the next show.
See, and another unique thing we had for a little while in Detroit was we'd do a full-page picture that I had shot, and the thing was to win tickets, you would have to send in your caption for that photo. Like, there was a time, I forgot who it was that brought two baby chimps into the dressing room one time, and we took a picture with Bull Curry with these two baby chimps. And, you know, we printed the picture, and it's like, okay, you send in your caption to win, you know, 2 free tickets. So that lasted for maybe a year. If, you know, like Detroit wrestling historians, you know, go back into their body presses and stuff like that and look into those kind of things.
Wow.
Now,
this is a question for both Tom and Dick. Do you guys still have any of the programs?
I have every issue of the body press that I know of that was ever printed.
Wow.
Something I will never get rid of.
I have quite a few programs. I don't have complete sets of everything, but I do have quite a few programs.
I've got so many programs that, you know, online that, you know, people ask me to sell, and it's like, you know, people, you know, it's really weird these days how, you know, I have all these programs, and I'd like to get them into, you know, collectors' hands, younger kids who want to learn the history of wrestling, but it's really weird how, you know, I've got these, you know, programs from the 50s and 60s, and people want to give you, like, 50 cents for them, you know, and it's like, you know, come on, really? You know, I haven't held on to these things all these years to just give them away to you. You know, some of them are, you know, Tom, you know, puts some stuff on eBay, and he makes a, you know, a cute coin sometimes on some of his programs. You know, so, you know, hey, I'll let it be known. I've got stuff for sale, but I'm not going to give it away. You know, same thing with body press programs. I got a bunch of extra body press programs. If you want to buy them, get a hold of me. I have them.
Yeah, my main focus my main focus for collecting programs right now is the body press, but not the Detroit body press, but that of the New England body press from the Tony Santos promotion. The name body press for the programs, there's 3 of them that I'm aware of, and those are the Detroit, of course, Boston with Santos, and the Calgary program from Stampede. Was also the body press.
There was some body press
and
down
there
in
probably
Texas.
Some in Texas as well. And I think there might have been some at one point, maybe in the Pacific Northwest, if my memory is right. I remember I saw something. But those are the only, but the 3 primary ones are the ones I mentioned earlier.
Now, if I could bring up another sub-subject of what we've been talking about, wrestling magazines, wrestling programs, but an untouched thing is fan clubs, you know, back in the 60s. You know, fan clubs were really big, and those fan magazines, you know, had a wealth of information in them. You know, Tom did, you did the Wrestling Register.
Yep.
I did the Michigan Scene. And then there was, you know, so many others, you know, that really dedicated, you know, their fan clubs to particular wrestlers.
Absolutely. And fan clubs go back to the days of the probably the late 40s with movie stuff, et cetera, which trickled into wrestling back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the earlier magazines from the 50s, like NWA Official Wrestling, Official Wrestling, and even The Wrestler, and not The Wrestler, but Wrestling As You Like It, they could have a column or a listing of all the different fan clubs. But what they said, they back in those days, it was specifically on one specific wrestler, not a general wrestling newsletter or bulletin or whatever you want to call it. You know, I think that came about probably in the late 50s and then predominantly in the 60s and in the 70s. It got more specific. Like Dave had the Michigan Scene. Other people would have other bulletins on certain geographic areas. Peach State Wrestling. Danny Goddard, of course, had the Sputnik Monroe fan club. And
right.
Bobby, didn't you have a fan club as well?
No.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
No, I never went that route.
We'll start one
that's
for you.
That's correct if I'm wrong, but wasn't Don Wilson, the Donovans,
he had the Donovans, yes.
Yeah, he had the Vern and Jack Donovan fan club, plus Don also did the fan club column for Wrestling Review.
Right, exactly.
And I remember back in the late 60s, because I would always be going to St. Louis, spending, you know, weekends and weeks on end with the Wilsons, and I'd be down there with Don and, you know, helping him write the column. You know, Don was a guy who could, he would push the deadline. He would wait till the last minute and then, you know, I got to get this done. It's like, okay, Don, give me this stuff, and we'd put it together, and I'd tell, okay, here's, I mean, you had George, you know, just so many great fans, you know, in the history of this sport who don't get enough credit. You know, just they were just icons in this business, just as, you know, good as some of the guys were. Like you have Georgian Orsi or Georgian, oh God, I can't, Marco Luca Nobilis. Yeah, she had Bruno's club.
Orsi and
J.J. Dillon, of all people, had Johnny Valentine's fan club.
Yeah.
Didn't Les Thatcher have a club also?
No, I don't think so.
In the 50s?
But I think he was. I think he was a member of different clubs.
Yes.
Yeah.
I remember, right, because I know. Who was it? Or am I getting him mixed up with? Bobby Shane was an avid fan club member of different clubs back in the day.
Yes.
And as I remember, he was at one of the fan club conventions before this was back in the 50s, long before WFIA days. And he was there, and Diane, that's when Diane Devine first met him. He was like a 12-year-old kid back then.
Well, and I met Jimmy Valiant before he even got into business at a fan convention in Cincinnati in 1966.
Okay, yeah.
You know, and then
yeah,
you
look
have,
at how many of those people came from. Like Dave was a photographer, Phil Moody, Percy Pringle, Paul Bearer.
Yeah.
Shot Clark was for the local newspaper here in Mobile. He also sent in results to both the Aftermags and the Wrestling Review. Rock Riddle, who was Steve Riddle, Rip Hawk's fan club.
Yeah.
Later,
and
got
you know,
Andy Gilbert.
Another. Go ahead.
You know, just
another
just people
person,
like that.
Jeff Walton was another fellow who
Fred
started
Blassie
a fan club, and Freddie Blassie fan, who went on to become part of the Hollywood Wrestling Office. You know, so, you know, there's a lot of us that started on that level and evolved into a greater area in professional wrestling.
And it was so good, you know, I was going to bring it up earlier, but I'm glad Les Thatcher brought it up, about Gene Gordon, you know, one of the greatest wrestling photographers of all time. And it really brought back memories of, you know, when... I forgot who asked, you know, what Gene did for a living. And remember, you know, Tom, Gene was a bellhop.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, and he never drove because of his, you know, injury.
Injury. He had a bad hook.
Yep.
And if you remember, Dave, he had thick glasses.
Yep. And, you know, just like Les said, you know, when I would, you know, when I lived down south in Charlotte, you know, trying to get a managing job in the, you know, Crockett territory. I was living with Sonny King down there. You know, Gene Gordon was right there in Charlotte, and, you know, I'd go over his house all the time. And just like Les said, his whole living room was basically a photo studio, and the guys from that territory would just come over Gene's house. He'd shoot pictures with him and do what, if you knew Gene Gordon, you'd do a lot of drinking when you went over his house.
With another one, a photographer that's probably second best known behind Gene, or possibly third behind Gene and George Napolitano out of New York, was Little Al Vavasour.
Oh, yeah, Little Al.
Oh, yeah.
And it was mentioned Tony Lanza. You know, I was really fortunate in the early part of my career when I was working for George Cannon, and we were filming TV in Montreal, and Tony Lanza, you know, came into the dressing room and wanted to shoot photographs when I was managing these guys, the Scorpions. And it's like, you know, oh, God, it was just wonderful to have my picture taken by Tony Lanza. And we talked, you know, for, you know, minutes on end on, you know, Detroit and me taking pictures and him. And just like he said, Tony Lanza was one of the best.
Tony Lanza was a great, great gentleman. I had the opportunity of spending a whole day with him about 3 years before he passed away. I was up in Montreal and made arrangements to visit him, and he invited me over to the house, and we had just a grand, grand time talking wrestling. And what a super, super guy. Oh, and honestly, Gene Gordon was a great photographer. Tony Lanz, a superb photographer. Just and both of those guys, two wonderful. Bob Leonard is another great photographer too.
Yep, Bob Leonard.
You know, he's another one of the best.
And who was Theo Arrett out of L.A. also?
Oh, yeah, he's another guy.
Tom, who was that used to shoot all the stuff in Buffalo?
Earl Elder. Earl Yetter.
There you go.
Earl Yetter.
Yep.
Earl Yetter.
That's right.
Yeah. Earl Elder was a guy from Baltimore. He was just a fan. But Earl Yetter was the guy out of Buffalo.
Right.
And he lived to be, God, he lived to almost to be 90, I guess, something like that. And out of the courtesy of the Lou Eskins hired, they still had his columns running, and it was the same Rex Sexton, you know? It was the same thing over and over again.
Hey, Mike, if you can put out any fans listening in, you know, we'd be glad to take some questions. And I know I've got one of my Detroit historians, Mark Bujan. He's got a ton of people that are listening in today. If they got any questions, give a call in. Give a shout, you know.
Give us a call. Our number here is 347-324-5735. Anybody that's got a question for anybody on the panel, give us a call.
And one thing, you know, hey, Bobby, if I could talk to you about, you know, your fire incident.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get burnt by the Sheik?
Yeah.
You know, God bless you for, you know, doing your kayfabe, but what you did, you know, what I remember what you said earlier, and I remember, you know, it was either Les or you mentioned about the sandpaper.
Yep.
Yeah, because that happened, I mean, I saw so many Sheik fire things here in Detroit, and there was a time the mighty Igor was going against the Sheik at a sold-out show, and Igor's manager, Ivan Kalmakov, took the fire, you know, like Igor ducked, and, you know, Kalmakov got the whole, you know, ball of fire in his face, and, you know, he worked it, you know, the towel over the face and stuff, and he got in the dressing room, and I sort of, you know, okay, you know, I'm, you know, sort of know what's going on, but then as soon as he got in the dressing room, he started rubbing his face with sandpaper. It's like,
oh, yeah.
What the heck is going on? And now he's rolling on the floor, and these bubbles are coming out of his face, and it's like, holy God, what just happened?
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, go get some ice. So I go to the, you know, like, you know, running down the hallway, you know, this was happened at Olympia Stadium, and I, you know, just go up to a vendor. I say, give me a bag of ice. And it's like, what? No, you got to buy. No, give me a bag of ice. The guy's on fire. So they give me a bunch of ice. I take it in the dressing room. And Ivan Kalmakov puts it on his face, and then, like, the very next day, we were going to another town. I can't even remember what town it was. And I met Ivan Kalmakov at this, what was the place? Howard Johnson's, you know, not far from my house. So we can go into the bathroom so we can take pictures of his face that was all bubbled up,
mm-hmm.
you know, which we used for, you know, the body press program and stuff like that. You know, but, you know, you said you, you know, just went into hiding for a week then, right?
Stayed hid for a week, and you take, I mean, you know, I was just a kid. I didn't know what I was doing, but they told me, and I mean, you can't believe how bad it hurts, but I sandpapered my face,
mm-hmm.
and then I used Mercurochrome to get the coloring, and then you put new skin over it, which is a liquid bandage, and you just build it up till it looks like a scab. It was an ordeal. And then, of course, you shave the eyebrows and singe the hair. And it was when I came back the following week and started working again, I had to I worked with bandages all on my face for a couple of weeks. But it was quite an ordeal. But, yeah, I mean, that was, I come as close to having to smarten up part of my family over that deal as anything I never did.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just, I mean, they were, I mean, my uncle was at the matches that night, and he was going insane.
The stuff some of us did for the business back then,
oh.
you know, which we never truly got paid for, you know, but we did it for the business and for the love of the business, you know, God bless us, you know, but the fire, you know, let me say this. When you got hit with the fire, no pain, right?
No.
Yeah.
they told me, what they told me that night was, they said, when the fire comes at you, close your eyes and blow.
Yep.
And you just blow, and the fire actually never, I mean, it goes around you, but it never, it will singe your hair, you know, a little bit, but nothing, there was nothing to it. I mean, it was, you know, it's over in a second and a half. It was over, but
yeah,
it's just,
you know,
the
illusion flash paper
that it leaves. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not really a lot of heat. It's just the paper going, and
yep.
You know, but the illusion, you know, of back then was just amazing.
That was actually the second time Bobby let Tom Ernesto talk him into doing something like that.
And what happened the first time?
The hard way you had to do on television. Bobby.
Well, that was on Atlanta. Well, that was just a. I mean, that was Bill Watts. That's during the war, when we were working for Gunkel, and Bill Watts had went on TV and was talking about how that we were nothing but a bunch of garbage men, and we didn't know how to wrestle, and we weren't throwing real punches, and blah, blah, blah. And Ernesto and Rock Hunter went on Atlanta TV and just beat the crap out of each other. And Ernesto, you know, he told me, he said, "Don't want to bust your eye open, but I want to blacken it." And he had me walk into a punch. Hardest thing I ever did in my life. Knowing it was coming and walk right into it. But there again, you're right, Dave. The things we did for the business and for the love of this business, and you know, you just did what you were asked, and you kept on going.
Yeah.
And me and Jerry talk about this all the time. If I was healthy enough and the business was the same, I'd pack my bag and be on the road tomorrow.
Yeah, you drive what, 100-200 miles, and you know the time it took to get there. You know, the time it took you to sit around the dressing room and, you know, be amongst the guys, and you finally go out there, you do your 15-minute match, you get beat to hell, you get your $15-$20 sometimes, and, you drive home, and, you know, when you sit and you didn't even really sit and ask about it, but you end up losing money.
No, yeah.
Over the course of the day.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was for the love of the business.
Guys, we got a caller in here. Let me get them on the line with us. Caller from area code 989. You're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi, Mike, Bobby, Jerry. This is Mark Bujan from Detroit.
Hey, Mark.
Mark, what's up, man?
Just want to say hi to you guys. Doing a great job. Say hi to Dave and Tom.
Hey, Mark.
Great show tonight. I was just wondering if Dave could talk about a new book he has coming out with Brian. Touch on that a little bit, Dave.
Essentially, a lot of the stuff is up on Kayfabe Memories right now. That you know, and I can't thank Mike enough for helping me out and, you know, posting those things. But a lot of those pictures and some that have never, you know, I've been holding back that, you know, people haven't seen yet. We're coming out with the second edition of this Saturday night. The History of Cobo Arena, and basically it's all my shots from basically 1970 through 1974 when I was the Sheik's photographer, and, you know, just everything, you know, photos and the captions like we do on Kayfabe, and, you know, it'll be a great book. It's, you know, over 200 pages, and, you know, what can I say? It's my personal history of being involved in, you know, big-time wrestling here in Detroit. And hopefully people like it, and, you know, they go to Wrestling Review and buy it, and even support some of the old issues of Wrestling Review magazine, which, you know, Brian Buchanis bought Wrestling Review and the whole archives of Wrestling Review, Wrestling Monthly, and Ring Wrestling from Norm Keitzer. And I think it was 2002, we revived the magazine and did, I think, maybe 12 issues over the next 6-7 years. And basically it was a labor of love from a lot of guys from around the country who did stories. Nobody ever got paid, but, you know, it was just for the love of the business. I mean, you know, I did a Cobo Confidential column, some stories, interviews from guys from this territory, guys like from Indianapolis, Mike Dupree, he chimed in, Mike Leno, whole bunch of guys. So if any old school wrestling fans out there want to learn anything about, you know, new about the guys from back in the day, you know, go to WrestlingReview.com, WrestlingReview, R-E-V-U-E, or WrestlePrints.com, and you can get some of those back issues.
Hey, Dave, got a question for you, David.
Yeah, Tommy.
Yeah, in all the years that you were taking photos for the Sheik, did you ever run into anyone who was hostile or didn't give a rat's ass or anything of that nature? It was very negative.
Fan-wise or worker-wise?
No, one of the boys.
Not really. You know, most guys were, you know, pretty good. Some guys could care less. You know, you had guys like Killer Brooks and Sheik and Bobo and Jerry Graham who, you know, were Cowboy Frankie Lane. I got to mention him. Ben Justice. You know, guys like that who would just bend over backwards to give you, you know, picks to work with. And when they were in the ring, you know, when they would see me around the ring taking pictures, it's like, you know, they got a guy in a hold. You know, they'd give you that snarl or the look or, you know, the, just the thing needed to, you know, make a great picture. Other guys, you know, they could have cared less, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, heat-wise, no, I really never had any of that. You know, some guys who... You know, I ask, you know, I'd sit down with them in the dressing room and ask them some questions, you know, can I get something for a story? And it's like, you know, basically they were, you know, like the Mighty Igor. Could have cared less.
Interesting.
Can I say one more thing, gentlemen? This is Mark from Detroit.
Go ahead, Mark.
I'd like to put a shout out, and Dave knows him. I think everybody knows Percival A. Friend.
Yeah,
he ended up in the hospital. If you guys could just touch on that, I'll let you go. You guys keep up the good work.
I'll talk to you soon, Mark. Thanks for calling in. Thanks for posting on your Facebook page and having all your guys tune in. Hopefully they're enjoying the show, and you know, hopefully they'll turn in every week to Peach State Pandemonium because this is one of the premier radio shows in the country.
Absolutely, one of the best.
Okay, you guys have a good night now.
Thanks,
take
Mark.
Take care, Mark.
Thank you.
All right, take care now. Bye-bye.
Yep. Yeah, Mark does a lot of stuff on Facebook that that I visit every day. That I tell you, it's amazing, guys like you and somebody we haven't mentioned that was going to try and call in at the top of the show, but hasn't been able to. Is Scott Thiel. Scott, again, he started, you know, back as a teenager putting out newsletters out of Florida, if I'm not mistaken, out of Tampa.
Yes.
And,
He did a fan blog.
Also did photography, worked with Dick Gulas, and has come up with something that is just spectacular in Crowbar Press. It's just one, you know, he's somebody who's keeping, you know, the old territorial days alive. Back when he used to do whatever happened to, you know, I pick up several of those, and he didn't focus just on the big name, you know, people. He focused on the journeyman guys like Frank Martinez and guys like Chris Von Goring and people that, you know, worked all over it, but they weren't big names, but, you know, they were still a part of the show. And their stories were just as interesting as Bruno San Martino would have been, or you know, Billy Superstar Graham, or anybody like that.
I agree with you 100% on that. Scott does a wonderful job. He's one of the best journalists we have in our business. I consider him a very dear friend, and I really enjoy his Whatever Happened to Him. They're just a fantastic publication.
Yep.
Yeah, I think he's at some point planning on starting those up again. And the fact that he does those and he's been doing them for so many years and has never made a dime out of them and is not doing them to make money. He's doing it as a love of the business, a love of the people in the business and everything. And it's just, you know, I can't say enough good things about Scott.
Yes, great guy. You know,
and well pressed, like the good housekeeping seal of approval.
You know, and me and Tom, you know, we go back, you know, way back into the 60s, and, you know, I love this guy. And when we were involved in the WFIA, you know, Tom, you know, how many, you know, just fans involved with the WFIA went to, you know, on into the business, went into the business, became wrestlers or managers. And it's like, you know, let's touch on another great photographer back, you know, in the early 70s who went on big, Jim Cornette.
Jim Cornette, Eddie Gilbert as another.
Eddie Gilbert.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mentioned Pringle.
You mentioned Eddie Gilbert. When Tommy was in this territory in the 70s, he rode with me a lot. And Eddie would, during the summer when Eddie was out of school, he was probably 13, 14, He would travel with us, and he would sit in the back seat, and he would write his stories. And, you know, I back then I didn't give it much thought. But you talk about a sponge. He soaked up everything that he came in contact with regarding this business.
Mm-hmm.
And we lost him way too soon.
Oh, way too
Absolutely.
Soon.
Absolutely. Way too soon.
Yeah, he was a great little kid, and like you said, he was a sponge. You know, when we would be around at the WFIA conventions, you know, he took to everybody. He had a great personality. Me, Tom, Eric Goldenberg, Tom Roberts, you know, and Eddie, we would just have so many laughs, you know, all the time, just, you know, clowning around,
yeah,
and just having fun.
A little side note about Eddie. One night he entertained us at one of the conventions doing impersonations of John Wayne, and he had everybody on the floor. He's a good kid. I tell you, I miss him dearly.
Yep.
And you think about it, though, all that he, all those trips he made, listening, you know, thinking up all that stuff, it helped him so much when he became a booker.
Absolutely.
To be somebody as young as he was, even though he'd grown up in the business, what a good booker he was. Same with Cornette. I mean, you know, all these things that these guys watched over the years and learned over the years and everything, you know, it helps them or helped them when they became bookers somewhere.
Yeah,
Jerry,
I remember Jimmy, you know, Jimmy was a photographer, and his mother would take him to all the shows around Louisville and, you know, around Kentucky and stuff like that. And I was still a photographer then, you know, here in Detroit, and I was dating a girl who lived in Louisville, Kentucky, Charlene Durnell. And sometimes I'd go down there, and that's another thread I might have to do, Mike, for Kayfabe Memories, because I have a bunch of photographs from, you know, Louisville. You know, it'll be a short thread, you know. I don't know. I may have like 100 or a couple hundred pictures, but there's some dandies in there that people have never seen before. So, and I'd meet Jim down there, and, you know, we'd talk about photography and stuff. And when I got into business as a manager, you know, Jim was still a young photographer and stuff. And I think it was 1976 Manager of the Year at the WFIA convention. And, you know, the one thing I said, there was, I know Jim Cornette was in the crowd. There was a couple other guys, John Arezzi, a couple other East Coast guys that I says, you know, just, you know, this is the greatest feeling you will ever have, you know, in this business of being in the business, working in front of a crowd. You know, if you can, reach for the stars, because tomorrow may never come. Just do what you want to do. Don't let anybody ever tell you that you can't do it. I mean, I had so many people, George Cannon and so many other guys, you don't want to do this. You don't want to, don't do it. You can't do it. You can't break the, you know, and I did. And working in this business of professional wrestling, performing in some of the greatest crowds, you know, around the country, there is no better feeling on the face of the planet.
Well, that's the truth. My career was nowhere near as well as what you guys all did. But I did the same thing. It took me. I went through half a dozen guys before I finally, you know, got guys who would agree to train me. And helped me break into business, and every one of them was the same thing. You don't want to do this. You don't want to do this. Ricky Fields told me one time, he said, it's like the mafia. It's hard to get into it. It's even harder to get out of. And that was true.
Yeah, it is. You know, I was out of the business for so long, and, you know, really, you know, after I sort of, you know, retired from managing and wrestling was, you know, sort of dying, you know, the territory stuff, and, you know, Vince was taking over, there was nothing left for the independents or, you know, territories anymore. So I was out of it for almost a good 10-year period, you know, until, you know, Brian Buchanan, you know, rang me up and says that he bought the, you know, rights to Wrestling Review and, you know, Ring Wrestling, you know, would I, you know, want to help him revive, you know, Wrestling Review again. And it's like, you know, that brought me back. And since then, it's like, you know, I got involved in the CAC, the Professional Wrestling Hall of Fame, you know, now Kayfabe Memories. I've been doing autograph shows and stuff like that. And, you know, it's just been a great revival. And I love talking, you know, just to the fans who may remember me either as a manager, as the photographer, the writer of the body press, whatever it may be, it, you know, just talking, you know, this old great wrestling history is just like fun.
Exactly. I agree. Hey, I was great. I have to leave, but I just want to say thank you for inviting me on, Mike, and anytime you want me on, I'd be more than happy to be on.
Tom, you're old. Why don't you just say, you got to go to the bathroom.
David, you know we go. Hey, Dave, do me a favor. After you get a chance, give me a call after all this is over with.
Okay. I know.
Okay.
You've been sucking on a little bit of old Overholt or something over there.
Great rye whiskey, kid, 105%. I'll get you guys later. Bye-bye.
All right, Tom. Thank you. Well, he could have always done what Jackie Fargo did when we had him on, just take the phone with you to the bathroom. Speaking of Jackie Fargo, the rumor went around, started by Jim Ross, of all people, that Jackie died over the last weekend, but that was not the case. He did have another bout. I don't know if it was his heart or what, but did have another stint in the ICU in Charlotte, but he is out. He got out of the hospital yesterday. Is back home. I haven't tried to call him to check on him or anything, but... he is doing well. He strutted out of the hospital, so evidently death can't beat him either.
Well,
I'm
hopefully he's doing well. And, you know, another shout out to Percival Al, friend who's in the hospital.
Yeah.
Al, get better.
Did he just go in the hospital, Dave?
I think it was 2 days ago he went
okay.
in.
Well, it's been kind of crazy around here. I had a memorial service yesterday, and I haven't been on a computer much. But we usually swap emails 2 or 3 times a week, so I hadn't noticed he hadn't been there. So,
shot an email to him about 2-3 weeks ago, because if you ever go on Al Friend's website, you know, he always has some good stories and stuff like that on there. And he hasn't done anything in a couple months. So I shot him an email and says, you know, Al, you know, what's going on? And he really didn't, you know, he was, you know, he says, you know, he really didn't say what was going on. And I says, you know, if you need me, you know, on a weekly basis, I'll do a story for you to keep your stuff going on the website, you know. And basically, you know, I didn't get an answer back. And now the latest thing I know is that he's in the hospital.
Okay. All righty. We never worked together, and I had never really met him or got to know him until Cauliflower Alley last year.
Mm-hmm.
And we spent a lot of time together. What a fantastic guy, funny guy.
Oh, he's funny.
Jeez, what a great guy.
Yeah, the thing is, you know, for wrestling fans listening into the show, if you've never been to the Cauliflower Alley Club in Las Vegas, you know, God, just make it a pilgrimage to come out there to meet some of your old heroes from days gone by. And now we're getting a lot of the, you know, guys, you know, WWE and, you know, TNA guys who are showing up and some of the independents. Yep. And the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame, if you can make it to that, if you've never been to Amsterdam, New York, to see an actual brick-and-mortar memorial to professional wrestling, there's nothing else like it on the planet. I mean, a lot of the guys have their, you know, I even have one of my outfits there, but if you want to see, like, outfits and masks and title belts and programs and magazines and really the history of professional wrestling, make it a point to visit the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame in Amsterdam, New York. And I would love, if somebody could send me some information on the Mobile thing, the reunion down there, and you know, I've heard it's just, you know, one of the premier events to, you know, go to in the country. And even though I've never worked down there, there's so many guys who attend that thing who, when I was a kid, you know, reading, you know, stories and the magazines and stuff, there's so many guys I respect and other guys who I did work in this business go to this thing. If somebody could send me some information, I would just love to attend this Mobile event.
Well, Mr. Norris happens to be a board member, so you're talking to the right person.
Yeah, well, send me the info. Let me book my ticket.
I will do that. I'll make sure that you get that. And in fact, Sonny King was here last year. He came to Mobile.
Yeah, oh, God. Sonny is, you know, what a great guy. And, you know, he's been out of the business for so long and been in hiding. And when I saw him 2 years ago in at the CAC in Vegas and we reunited, it's like, it was amazing.
Hadn't changed all that much. He still looks like he could get in the ring if he needed to. He's still
looks good.
Jerry doesn't change either. I think Jerry's nodded off on us, guys.
I'm right here, brother.
When these guys got started, me and Jerry are like a brown pair of shoes at a black tie formal tonight.
I'm sorry, brother. They don't call me Supermouth for nothing. So
hey, listen, I've enjoyed this.
You know, I can't wait for the time because, like I said, Jerry, after the show that Mickey Doyle was on last time, after the show, I called him up and we were talking, and he was talking you up like, you know, you were the next Bruno Sammartino that never was. And, you know, he just had so much respect for you. And then, you know, after that, you know, it's like I went on YouTube and tried to find some matches of, like, you know, Jerry Oates. And it's like, gee, oh, man, you were one heck of a worker. You know, I'm sorry you never made it up to Detroit here because, God, I would have loved to have seen you.
I did.
You were in Detroit?
I was coming up there when Murdoch was coming. I worked on the first match they ever had in Joe Louis Arena. I worked with a Sheik on the main event.
See, now that was after I was already gone.
Okay.
I was going to say, because I've got pictures of you and Dave McKinney together, Bear Man, is in a tag team match.
I think you
worked with Baba. Yeah, Baba and Jumbo Saruta, maybe?
Send me that picture.
Okay, I will. I still haven't sent you that picture. I know you want a picture of Sweet Daddy Watts. I'm going to send you that, too.
Shoot me that one, too, brother. Hope it's autographed.
Yeah.
Could he write? I don't know. If he wrote like he talked, he'd fill up the page. Well, guys, we are out of time. Dave, I appreciate you joining us.
Yes.
I really thank you for having me.
Mark, Don, all these guys, Les Thatcher. I'm sorry Scott wasn't able to call in, but we're going to get him on here again in the very near future, and this has been a fun show.
Yes, it has.
I appreciate you guys coming in.
Well, I thank
Happy
you, Mike,
year,
for having me. Much appreciated, Jerry. You know, God bless you. Have a happy new year. Bobby, I hope, we meet sometime soon and, you know, I can reconnect with your wife. You're the luckiest man on the face of the planet.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it. I think so, too. Mike, get him that info for Mobile. We'll get him down there and we'll really educate him.
Oh, boy. Somehow I feel some potatoes coming. Somehow I feel a lot of potatoes coming my way.
Oh, listen, man. 4 days with Charlie Smith, you'll be glad to get back to Detroit.
Thanks, guys, right, for having me on. Much appreciated.
We will get together again next week, guys, and do this one more time.
Sounds good. Safe. See you this weekend, my boy.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.